This first conversation with Catherine Mahon took place at the Luna House Museum in Lewiston on August 27, 1976. The interviewer was Sam Schrager.
You know, he found out cement basements could get pretty wet.
Did Joe Alexander have a store down here as well as just the one in Julietta?
Oh, this was his uncle.
Oh, his uncle.
This was Uncle Joe, the original Joe. The one in Julietta was his nephew. Named for him, of course, but it was his nephew. And Joe and Amanda Johnson. But it was his uncle down here. And of course, his uncle financed him in the beginning, set him up in the store, you see.
They were Jewish, weren't they?
Oh, yes. They would have said, we're not Orthodox Jews. But Joe was all Jew. Some of them, you know, then, well, Joe was all Jew. Some of them, in his generation, most of them didn't marry Jewish. And in Lewiston, they associated with other people more than any of the other Jewish families, and most of them socially, and most of them did not marry Jews. In fact, I don't know if they did not. The other Jewish families, the Bernard and Goldstein, mostly married Jewish people. They stayed a little more, they were more Orthodox Jew. And Joe, I mean, they didn't. Joe had a brother, old Joe, who wasn't here very much, and it was his brother's wife who kept house for him. And these were his brother's children. Of course, Scuttlebutt had it that a lot were Joe's, because the brother was gone a heck of a long time, and the children arrived regularly. It was a large family. But nobody knew. She was quite German, Jewish, yes. Didn't mix much. Everybody knew Joe, and everybody liked him. And she was not a social person, but the children were. Some of them were very, very popular. There would be no party in Lewiston for young people that some of them, that age wouldn't go to, which wasn't always true of the other Jewish families, but they mixed more. And I know one granddaughter of Uncle Joe, I knew very, very well, and she's Jewish, but we're not Orthodox Jews. Of course, she was only half Jewish. Her father wasn't Jewish, but her mother was, a niece, a brother, a sister of the Joe that was at Julia. And, but you see, Joe up there didn't marry a Jewish girl. He married a Julia girl, you know. And they never went to the church, to their synagogue particularly, when it came time to marry or anything, they didn't bother. And I know in that generation, they weren't strict about keeping the, oh, you know, not eating ham or
kosher.
They weren't kosher at all. And I don't know whether in the family house, though, old Joe may have been somewhere. Because his sister-in-law, was a Mrs. Alexander, who kept house, ran the place. She was also Jewish. She was a German Jewish. Was a brother of the merchant, and he didn't amount to anything, and he'd show up, and I know my mother said the reason she gave credence to the story that they were both. She heard him call up once and talk. What do you want? Money, I suppose. and well, he wants here. Well, we don't need to see you. You know. You just come around for some money, I suppose.
Was the old Joe a widower?
Bachelor? I don't know. Now, frankly, you've asked me something, I don't know.
I'm just curious, because
I don't
it's an
know.
Interesting family.
I don't know.
Well, this
had
younger,
no wife in Lewiston.
This younger Joe, do you think that that there were some people who would hold it against him that he was a Jew in Juliet, or say
no.
Not a trade with him because of that?
Didn't
matter.
No,
didn't
matter. And of course his wife wasn't, and they were established people.
In Juliet, did they?
They mixed completely.
They probably didn't go to church, though, or did they?
No, I don't think they did. In Juliet was kind of a church town. If they did, it would be his wife's church. You know, but I don't suppose he went. But I think it was just like anybody else that didn't attend a church. Juliana had a lot of churches. They had a Catholic church way up on the hill. They had a small, they had a Methodist, United Brethren? Oh, glad they had a whole bunch of
They had United Brethren, too.
Yes, and I think there was something else in the beginning. It was kind of, there was quite a few churches for a while, almost more than the town could support. I think the Methodist has been the main survivor up there, hasn't it?
I think
and
so.
And I think maybe United Brethren, that was a strong church up there. I think quite a few people went to it. Mm-hmm. But the Methodist was quite prominent. Now I don't know what else.
I understand that that there were a lot of revivals in those days, just all the time.
I presume there were. Now, that I don't know the word in Lewiston. They were around these kind of a thing, you know, to have them. Palouse had a lot of churches. And had, not much. There were a few Catholics, but I don't know if they've been in the church or not. The sisters have been the same. Then they came and taught school one summer. But there were a few Catholics there, but not many. There was a group of Episcopalians. There was the Christian church, the Methodist, a lot of them. We had quite a few.
From what I can understand talking to people, I get the idea that some people really preferred the evangelical type of Christianity. Some people like the more staid kind. You weren't too demonstrative.
There was a definite difference there. And of course, it was quite a difference. Now, some Methodists stayed quite straight, and some were quite demonstrative. And in the groups, I know there were some that would not be quite so thrilled that the ones that got up and shouted, and they called them the shouting Methodists and the others, you know. But one very dear, sweet pioneer Methodist in Lewiston, that was my mother's very close friend, Grandma Pierstark, had a way of, she couldn't do those things, you know. I mean, she never shouted and made an exhibition. But they had a minister here who wasn't too popular. The poor fellow tried too hard. He just tried too hard. He tried to be young with the young people too much. He tried to be with everybody. And he had a perfect knack of putting both feet in his mouth and making people mad. And Mrs. Wright, her husband was a pioneer blacksmith and a very well-to-do man here, liked to attend that church, but they were all down on the flat because it was convenient, and especially, I think, on a Sunday evening. Of course, there wasn't much social life. That was kind of a thing to do. And it was handy for her, but she wasn't a member of that church and didn't intend to be. Maybe she belonged to another one or something. She had definite ideas that way. But she sort of liked to go over there. But she told Grandma Pierstrup, she said, every time I go, he gets out there real quick, you know, to shake hands. And he says, I'm still praying for you, Mrs. Wright, I'm still praying for you. She makes me sound like a terrible sinner, you know. And Grandma Pierstrup smiled, and she said, well, just telling the prayers that the righteous availeth much. Oh, good. Yeah. Colfax and Palouse, I know.
Bernard was a Jewish name.
Oh, yes, and they were all related. And Bernard and Lewis, and they came from them. Now, Joe Alexander had a story in Grangeville with Frederick, another Jewish film. It's the ANF, and it's still the ANF store. And I think maybe in Genesee.
In Genesee, it was Rosenstein and
Jake Rosenstein.
Yeah.
A very, very dear friend of my grandfather's.
Oh, really?
Very close. They were chums. And I said to my mother later, I'd always known, you know, she knew these different Jewish people. But Jake Rosenstein and his friend, they were very close. He was my grandfather's closest. They were just chums. And I knew he had befriended him up regularly in Oregon, and he'd gotten his relatives down there to help him, and they had financed him at times. They had helped my grandfather. And they had been so good to my grandfather, my mother, his relatives, and everything. And I said, well, now the Jewish people generally stick together, you know. They're kind of Flemish. And how did it happen? We aren't Jewish. There's no Jewish blood. And how did that happen? And Mother said, well, you know, we never thought about it. It was just Pop's best friend was this Jewish, Jake Rosenstein. And she said, it must have been the language. They could speak the same type of the Low Dutch or German. And maybe it was that, when they were both had struggles with language when they came to this country. And they just happened to like each other. Of course, everybody liked Jake Rosenstein in Genesee. Now, talking about the Jews and it being accepted, in these small towns, there weren't many Jews, so there was never a ghetto.
Never
a ghetto, you know. They lived with other people. They went to the other schools, and they, if there was any association, it was. And they were mostly accepted. And as I say, very often didn't marry Jewish. Now, sometimes they did, and those were the more kosher Jews. But lots of them kind of drifted away. Well, there was no synagogue, there was no rabbi, and they didn't go to the other church, but they still weren't very strong in theirs. And they were accepted. They were much more accepted and assimilated than the Jews in the big cities. In all the Western towns at that time, the Jews, as merchants, were part of the community. And Jake Rosenstein in Genesee was loved. I remember in my business, one man, something, he said, you knew Jake Rosenstein? I said, no, I never saw him, but he was my grandfather's best friend. And this was a very substantial older farmer from up there, and not Jewish. I think he was probably Lutheran, because there were many. But he said, my father told me, always you buy from Jake Rosenstein. You would have starved to death without Jake Rosenstein. And there had been this panic in the 90s or something.
93.
And they had been very hard up. And Jake Rosenstein gave them all credit very nicely and graciously and was very good to them. And they respected him. And everybody in town liked them. It would sometimes, if they were rather kosher, it would come up when it came time to marry, whether they would marry a Jew. And then it would be a difference, you see. And it was just as apt to be that the Jewish people were objecting to marrying somebody else more than the others would to marry a Jew. Of course, they probably wouldn't have become a Jewish person, which is difficult to become, to go into that faith, I understand. I guess you have to go through quite a bit. But Jake Rosenstein had wanted to marry out of the religion. He had been in love with a girl in Oregon. And I should have married Mary. But she wasn't Jewish. And she was kind of, in his mind, the beautiful it might have been. But his family didn't approve and all, and he didn't. He thought it was better to marry Jewish. And the girl he married, and everybody in Genesee liked her very much. In fact, she was among the townspeople almost more liked than he was very German. She came from Germany, and they were courting at his brother-in-law's house, I think it was, in Oregon. My mother was visiting there as a child, and she could hear them talk. They talked in German in the parlor. They put them off in the parlor to talk. They were courting. And their family was very making the match. This was very much their approval. And Mother said it was all in German, so the kids could listen, but they couldn't understand a word of it, you know. And they knew they were kind of courting off in the parlor, and they were kept out of the parlor at that time. Friends liked her very much, but he was very jealous of her. He was a man, and nobody knew it. And I know, but I said that to one girl that lived in Genesee, and she was, that what's the matter with him? That that was the most ridiculous thing. It was no reason at all. He'd be jealous of the bookkeeper. He said, I'm just a good bookkeeper, and I don't want you to done without him, because the two worked and ran a store, and they prospered. And I know his wife was away once, and there was a fair in Lewiston, and of course fairs were one of the big things, and my mother was always active in them, and she was secretary of the Poultry Association. And knew all the people in the fairs that made the circuit. And I know his two little girls came down and stayed with her to go to the fair, and Mother said they were so cute and bright. And I think, however, I'm not sure, when they grew up, they went to school, whether they really, whether they went married Jewish or not, I'm not positive. But they were very smart. They went to college and all, and were, she said, oh, such an attractive little kid, girl. She just adored them. And she had them as her house guests so they could go to the fair, which was a normal thing. When my grandfather was in Oregon, as I say, he met Jake, I don't know just how, and he was a stage driver, and he'd been on a mail route from Looking Glass near Roseburg to Albany, I think. And one of Jake's relatives financed him to buy his equipment. And they had a disastrous barn fire, and it burned. And it wasn't paid for yet. And he just immediately financed him again, when some people wouldn't have. And of course, my grandfather did pay him back. But they were, he was so generous. It wasn't any arguments, like no hassle like a bank would give you nowadays. And why didn't you this? And of course, they didn't have insurance. And why this and why that? And my mother, who was considered very sickly and the kind, too bad she'll never live to be growing child in the winter area, they knew she wasn't very well. And they would say to him, well, bring Laura over. And she would go and be their house guest. And now they were quite wealthy, more than the average person. And they would just take her into the family, and they were marvelous to her. And Mother said she did eat a lot more over there than her folks could possibly tempt her.
Was this Jake's family?
This was his relatives of his.
His relatives?
Yes, in Oregon. And you see, then
and he lived with his relatives.
Well, he peddled. He was a Jew peddler. He carried a pack in the beginning. And had quite a hard time. He was a poor Jew, he would say.
Was it at Roseburg?
Out from there. Relative in Roseburg and in Albany. There were the two there.
Two families in Germany.
Well, all related. Uh-huh. All these Jews were related. I think it was his sister's husband or something. I think, let me see, what was that name of the ones in Oregon? One of them was famous for he and his mule. They came to Roseburg. They were a very prominent Jewish family there. And one lived in Albany, brother, and one in Roseburg. And they were among the rich people of the places, each one. When my mother was in Albany visiting them, they had a pet, one of the children in the town. Now this shows that they mixed in the town a great deal, died. And they had a funeral for him. And they had a little pet cemetery there. And all the children, and she said there was about 15 or more of us. She went with the others, and we had a funeral for that pet, and they buried it in this pet cemetery. And she had never seen anything quite like that.
His family had the pet cemetery.
No, it was the town had a pet cemetery.
Okay.
I said Albany. I think that was in Oakland. Near, I don't know. Albany or Oakland. That's where his bus ran. It was one of the terminals. Oakland, maybe. I know it on the map in the Roseburg country. Roseburg was there.
It wasn't that far from Roseburg.
Oh, well, it took quite a little trip in the horse and buggy days, and that was horse and buggy days.
Of course, Albany is already almost up towards Portland.
Yes, but they did go. I think this was Oakland.
Well, I'll check it out.
Toward the coast, I think it's more. Uh-huh. And, of course, all travel was by stage. You see, and my grandfather was a stagecoach driver. Carried the mail. The mail was the important thing. That's what kept the stagecoach going. Your passengers were that much velvet in your freight. There was this good byproduct of being that you would be in the towns and you could shop very nicely. And if there was a fresh fruit that was a little bit scarce, maybe at Palouse, well, he could bring it from Colbacks. Or if there was fresh fruit that was maybe it would be a fish, because they didn't have much fish, you know, this would be right. Well, then the Burns family would have fish. He'd bring enough to maybe sell. He'd know somebody that would buy it, maybe a hotel. And he'd always make enough on what he'd sell them to furnish his own. But it meant that they had a rather good table in their house. And my grandfather being a thrifty European family, but he wanted a nice table. He wanted to be sure there was always ham and always things like that in the house, you know. But he liked to have those things. And my grandfather was some things he would indulge himself in, very thrifty, but in the 90s or 80s, he would pay a dollar for a choice can of sardines and cheese when it was available. And that would be a thing he would buy. Wanted cheese, loved it. And, or as I say, if there was fresh fish or something, and fruits. And they always had a can of fruit, a bottom can, on Sunday. And it was in Palouse, and it was custom when most of the households, they baked a nice cake for Sunday dinner. But at the Burns home, they had cake plus fruit.
The Burns.
That was my mother's maiden name, B-E-R-N-S, the European spelling, like Bern in Switzerland. And my mother said some of her friends very much liked an invitation to dinner, because when the cake would be about the same, but there would be this fruit. And she said, looking back, it wasn't all that wonderful. And they generally paid close to 75 cents at least, and sometimes more, for this can of fruit. And she said it was quite often a lot of a juice and all that, but it was fruit that they didn't have otherwise. Well, home canning hadn't progressed as far either. And then fruit was scarce. In the early days up there, most of the people had the currants and raspberries. Quite soon, they spread those around. But fruit, except when they came down and brought it up from the river, which they did. It came up from the river. You know, there's these roads leading down from all that country to the river. And once when she was sick, one man rode clear down there and brought back a box of peaches for her. And she was, maybe 12, 13, but a friend of the family and liked her, and he made that whole trip. And it was a long ways by horseback. He did it on horseback because he could carry the box on horseback.
Is this from Palouse?
From Palouse. Mm-hmm. From Palouse. And you see, Palouse was Colfax. And then they had a road to Moscow. Moscow was there. And Pullman was a very small town in those times. Very small. Pullman didn't grow until they got to college, which Palouse could have had. It was going to be located at Palouse, Pullman, or Colfax. Whitman County was to get it. And Palouse was so sure they were the one to get it that they didn't make any concessions much. But buy our land at a good price. Colfax didn't have a good place for it. They were the county seat, and they thought they'll have to come here. And Pullman just got in and worked like the Dickens to them. We'll give you this, we'll give you that, we'll give you the other thing, and they got it. And of course, you know it's hilly. It's not the best location, but it was to go to Whitman County, and it was set between those towns, and they got it. Palouse could have had the lumber mill that went to Potlatch. They again didn't make the concessions. They missed out several times, but in my mother's day, the St. Elmo was quite a hotel. And you know, up there now, a lot of people don't even know the name St. Elmo, but that's that old brick building with a mansard roof on Main Street in Palouse.
It was the St. Elmo in Kendrick, too, wasn't there?
I don't know.
I think I've been told that. Some
there may have been.
An old timer told me they had the same name hotel.
Well, it was the hotel.
In Palouse.
Oh, yes. And, you know, it was the hotel. Now, it wasn't run by a French madam like lots of our hotels were. It was, they were purely American. In Lewiston, we had two hotels run by French madams, and I know in where my father lived in Eastern Oregon they did.
Was one of those the De France?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I heard that, about that one.
Mm-hmm. De France, and then the Raymond House was from Madame Raymond Saux, S-A-U-X. My mother said the first time she saw it, she said, "Socks, what is that?" But it was so. And
what were these French ladies like?
Very efficient businesswomen who were there to run a hotel and make money. Generally, if they had a husband, he helped them, but they were just purely businesswomen. Definitely, they ran a hotel and a restaurant and charged. It was rather an efficient operation, I would say. And a businesswoman, a very very definite businesswoman in the 80s, and there weren't too many things a woman could do, you know. But that was one thing they could do. And even if they had a husband, generally speaking, they were the brains. They watched out for everything. They could probably go in and cook if they had to, but they hired a cook. They could make beds if they had to. They could wait on the table if they had to, but they didn't especially do it. They were overseeing it and were quite workers.
Did they have a respected role in the community?
Oh, yes. They were generally quite strict. When my mother went into Burns, Oregon, for the telephone company, they sent her in to take charge of the office, and her instructions were to get the keys before she told anybody her business, because the big company had bought out the small little local company, and they weren't keeping books. They had never kept books. It was, everybody out of the one thing, and were horrified, and they wanted to systematize it. And they were going to train their own operators, but I don't suppose they had told the family that they would immediately fire their help, and it were relatives, the girls. But they wanted anything that was there, because it was supposed to be their money. And they knew this Mr. Bush that had handled the deal and was the Northwest traffic manager for the company, and that everybody feared and trembled that was in the company when he came along. And here, of course, these people hadn't been at all. So his instructions to my mother were, get the keys before you tell anybody what your business is. Well, you did what the boss said. And she arrived in Burns from Portland. She'd been there for a while and probably looked a little more city, a little different, dress. And it was court week in Burns, and a lot of people came in. And of course, ladies that were kind of gay congregated there more for that time, because there was more money being spent. And she asked for a room. What is your business? And I said, I can't tell you my business. Then you cannot have a room. And so Mother said she had ridden over the mountain. She was so miserable, cold, mud spattered, and hungry and tired. And she thought, I have to have a room. I'll just start crying right here in the lobby if I don't have a room. I just can't stand it without a room, She looked at her and she said, he told her which hotel was the leading hotel to go there. Because he'd been through, and of course the telephone company was paying her expenses. She said, do you know the people in the telephone, have the telephone? Well, it was so-and-so, the Wrights or the Smiths, I don't know the name now. And she said, are you acquainted? No, not really. And she said, I took a chance. And she said, well, I'm here to take over. And I'm not supposed to tell this. Oh. Well, then you can have a room. And so after a while, she'd been there a little bit. She was going to move. Her mother didn't stay long enough, but she had an annex across the street where her daughter lived. And she was educating her daughter in music and what have you, and she was to be the fine lady. Her daughter lived over in the annex, which was very exclusive. And she was going to move her over into the annex. So that meant that she was approved, quite that she was a sufficiently proper person. But she got her room, but she had to tell her business first. In Lewiston, Melina So was one of the most popular young ladies in the high social circles.
A daughter of?
The daughter of Madame So, and her sister, Mrs. Timberlake, didn't care about things that way, but I don't think she would. Who she at that time ran the business, and I don't think that I know she thought she was as good as anybody, and that would be that. And it was just that she was business. And you see, there were women have always managed some things, but they didn't have the same opportunities. You could be a milliner and run a milliner shop, and that was one of the best businesses. My grandmother did that. Or you could run a hotel or a boarding house. If you were a dressmaker, unless you were in a big place, you were just maybe kind of, it wasn't as good a job. Or you could teach school, and it was a very poor job. Might be a 2-month school here or a 2-month school there, and once in a while they got decent pay. And the clerks in the stores were not women. They were men most of the time. They were just barely, in the 90s they began to have women clerks. But in these little stores, you bought your ribbons and your yard goods from a man. They were all men in the stores. I suppose part of it was because it was a general store and there was a lot of lifting in parts because they bought things in quantity. But men did it. So how many things could a girl do? You know, she could be a hired girl. Somebody's hired girl.
I've heard about that a lot. A lot of women did that.
Oh, yes. And it really wasn't that bad a job, but it wasn't that good a job either. We wouldn't like it. But they were. That was the difference there was, do they eat with the family or not?
Right.
And some of them would not go where they didn't eat with the family. And a few people wouldn't, and then they were putting down quite a lot of errors if the hired girl didn't eat with the family in some of these homes. But a few people, a few professionals and that, would not let the hired girl eat with the family. And they were a wealthy home, they might have two hired girls. But the average hired girl ate with the family.
She did. That's interesting. I always wondered about that.
Oh, yes. And then it was told that one place, one that was putting down errors, didn't allow the hired girl to have dessert. The pie were carefully counted. So they didn't have it sometimes too easy. That was a place that was considered hard to work, but they paid a little more.
What about what was expected of a hired girl? Didn't that vary a lot in different moments?
Yes, but they just did everything. They just helped with the work. They did, you know, washing was done by hand, and they probably did the washing, and the ironing was tremendous, and they cooked, and they took care of kids, and did the usual things, I guess, that were done around it. And generally, it was a lot to do. It was a big family. Generally, the housewife herself worked right along with them, and the children, if they were old enough, in lots of homes. They just became an extra member of the family sometimes. But, and then if it was a more old banker or a lawyer that was putting on a little more front, well, then maybe there was more distinction. But in the average home, they were really just like another member of the family that was like an older child. They'd grown up and was helping more. And then, of course, they were table waiters in the hotels and the waitresses. And the waitresses didn't have as good a standing quite. I think because they felt they waited on the drummers that came to town. And that, and maybe they went with them some because they were throwing them in. That wasn't as a rule. Now that varied. Some waitresses had very good standing, but sometimes maybe not quite as good. Probably it was a little better job than the hired girl, but still, job-wise, I think maybe looking back on it, I probably would have rather been a waitress than a hired girl. I'm quite sure I wouldn't like to have been a hired girl. But there weren't very many things for women to do, and. I know my mother wanted to work, had something. Her father owned stock in the store, so she was putting pressure on. They were beginning to hire women a little bit, and he was beginning to put a little pressure on them. I'm not hiring Laura, you know. But the telephone came to Palouse, and one other girl was hired. But after she'd been there about 4 months, she wanted to leave town, and she decided to. Somebody, I think her father put in a word with somebody too, who knew her folks, and she didn't have any special friends, so she sent word for my mother to come. And she went to work for the telephone company. Well, her wages were as much a month as a school teacher got, which wasn't large. I think it was about, $20 a month, something like that. And but that was about what lots of schools paid. And it was 12 months a year, but she worked. About 12, 14 hours a day, and you worked half a day on Sunday as a rule. But still, it was a 12 months a year job. It wasn't 2 months over there and 2 months over here and off in between, you know.
She'd already had that experience in Burns.
No, that, this was long before Burns.
Oh, this was before.
That was when she started working for the company, and she worked there, and she heard, they decided to come to Lewiston. The company was going to send somebody to Lewiston. And they wanted somebody to go, and they decided that she had trained in this time of somebody that could relieve her at Palouse. And so they said, well, you could send that. And she said, well, I kind of think I'd like to go. And they said, well, yes, if you want to go, you can. So she had heard that Lewiston was a promising town that might grow. And she decided to come to Lewiston, although it meant some hardships because she could live at home. And her mother was dead, but she and her father had Palouse. And she came down to Lewiston. And when she came to Lewiston, she came down the hill, the Lewiston Hill, with Molly, the early stage driver. And she stayed at first at the Raymond House. But that was too expensive. Meals were 50 cents. And she couldn't afford to stay there. So her first home here was with the Thatchers, that started the bookstore. Grandma Thatcher and Grandpa Thatcher. And he had been in this country in the 70s. He was Indian agent on the first. And Grandma Thatcher would still tell those times with black eyes snapping about the time they stole the Capitol in the middle of the night.
Did she tell the boys that
story? Oh, yes, and was very indignant.
Would you tell me the way? How was it?
I don't know too much, but she said they came in the middle of the night, which they did, really, you know, to move the things. I guess it was inevitable that they would, but they removed things in the middle of the night. Took it to Boise. And of course, at one time, Lewiston, you see, was the head for all, you might say, Northern Idaho mostly. And Moscow began to grow. And when they divided the counties, there was a lot of bitterness about how much they gave. And Genesee, you see, was given to Moscow. And they said, we were afraid. Some of the Nez Perce people, why did you give all that? You didn't have to. And they said, we gave them Genesee and kept as close as we could so that they would not split off and make another county. And Genesee was the town they thought might be, want to be a county seat too. So they put Genesee over with Moscow to keep them from being another county. And you see, once their water was Nez Perce, and I always will say Latoa, we're all part of Nez Perce County.
Well, when your mother stayed with Mrs. Thatcher, was she boarding with her?
Yes, she boarded with her. Now, they didn't regularly keep boarders, but they did take her. And she stayed there for a while, and then she stayed with Grandma Pierstorff. It was a little cheaper, and she felt that she needed to save that money. And she said afterwards, maybe I should have stayed, but of course she loved Grandma Pierstorff, too. But one of the Thatcher boys, he said, why do you want to move down there? Mrs. Thatcher said, well, now, Mrs. Pierstorff is a very nice lady, and that will be all right. And she was a darling. But, of course, she always stayed a very close friend of the Thatchers, too. She just really was very fond of them. And at that time, Mrs. Thatcher herself, she kept a little buggy, of course. But she had a very lovely set of Shakespearean books that were leather-bound and valuable in the 90s, very valuable. And the Houghton Mifflin salesman, he came around. See, we didn't have libraries, so you bought a book. And the amount of books you bought was kind of a sign of whether you had any culture or not. And books were loaned very carefully, and they were very treasured things. And she had this lovely set of Shakespeare. And he had taken it down to the store and had it on exhibition. It was kind of an attraction. And this salesman said, I'll give you $100 for it. 100 was like 1,000 now or more, you know, in those days. And he told it at the table. They ate quite nicely on white linen and so forth, you know. And so Grandma said, well, you didn't sell it. Oh, he said, of course not. You sure you didn't? No, you're sure? I think I'll go and get it. I don't think I'll leave it down there anymore. I think I'll go and get this afternoon. And she did. She had the horse hitched up and she went and got her set of Shakespeare because if they were casting longing eyes on it, she was not going to put temptation in anyone's way by getting them. So she did.
And did, later, did they have the bookstore at that time?
And they had the bookstore. Uh-huh. Yes, he had retired from the government and had the bookstore. It was Thatcher.
So she was bringing it back home from the bookstore.
Yes, she brought it back home. She wouldn't leave it in the bookstore anymore. If they were going to offer that kind of money, why... No, it might not be safe there, so she brought it home. And it's still, I think, supposedly in the family, but it wasn't in the branches I knew. I asked one of the granddaughters once, we belong to the same service club, and I said, who has the leather-bound Shakespeare? I don't know. Don't know anything about it. I said, well, I do. You know, your grandmother had it. She said, I'll ask mother. Yeah. Aunt so-and-so has it.
So the number of books that you have is really an important measure of the culture that you
have. It had something to do with it. Yes, it did. Books were a luxury, an expense, and you see, freight had been important. and shipping books are heavy, and they weren't absolutely basic that you had to have a book to live, you know. So they came with culture. They generally had a Bible, although my mother said she overheard her mother say once about a sister that she wasn't too happy about her. She loved her, but she wasn't happy about some fractions. And she said, "I don't think they have a Bible in the house." And she was very worried about that, but they always did have the family Bible, I think. But that might have been sometimes about the only book in some homes.
Were books that were in homes read carefully? I
think so. In the beginning, maybe later, you know, as they were handed down, not so much. But they were in the beginning, yes, and loaned from person to person quite a bit. One of our early, well, one of the first of the Alfred boys, Albert Alfred, founder of the Tribune, always wrote in his book, stolen from the library of Albert Alfred. So anytime you had that book, if he loaned it to you, it was stolen from the library of Albert Alfred. So you'd know it'd have to go back. And on all his shelves, that was in there. Very important, from the library of Albert Alfred. And quite nice writing in there, or sometimes a very elaborate stamp or something, or very nicely done Spencer on the flyleaf or on the book. Who, you know, it belonged to. And you, well, you'll find it, if you buy an old book in a bookstore now, quite often on the flyleaf, it'll be who it's to and who it's from. The gift, because it was a gift. I know I bought a vinyl portrait, Meredith, recently, because I had lost this book. It had gotten ruined. And I saw it in this antique store. And it's in there. Of course, the name means nothing to me because I bought it in another town, but to so-and-so, such and such a date from so-and-so, you know.
Who was the author of the book?
That was Meredith. I bought
George
Lucille.
Barry?
Yes, Lucille. I bought, you know, the one that says that civilized man cannot live without books, can live without music, live without art, civilized man. And I had had a very, very, a really nicer volume of it, padded leather. It got ruined, and I regretted it. It was my mother's. And this is a good volume. It's like some of my other poetry, but it's not quite as good as what I lost. But anyway, I replaced it.
How old was your mother when she was living in Lewiston, working for the phone company?
Oh, let's see. Mother was born in 72. Yeah. She came here in 93, the
so
spring of 93.
20, yeah. 21.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A young woman. Uh-huh. And business. And I know, you remember that was somewhat the Victorian age. There, Edward, I guess, was on the throne, wasn't he? But they were of that print time. And her mother, well, not an active member, but her folks back had been Quakers. Her mother had been raised away from it, but she still had a little bit of that strictness about it. And she belonged to another church, because it was the only church in the town where she joined. But they were raised in rather a strict way, all of them. And I know one said, well, were there strict rules on the company about how the operators were to behave? And I said, well, you would have lost your job if you hadn't been respected in the community. But I think the rules were made more by the people themselves, the operators. They had their standards. And I don't think it was that the company said, you would have lost your job, yes. But I don't think they said, you can't do this or you can't do that. I think those were self-imposed rules. And you just said, had to be respected in your community, or they wouldn't hire you. But beyond that, I don't think they spelled anything out. I think the people themselves did.
Judgment by your peers.
Yes, I think it was. They were in, you know, it was a society that did that. They frowned on things. And not that there weren't, that they didn't do a lot of the things that people do now. They did, but they were rather careful. I think it always comes back to that, anyway, you're judged by your peers. If it's, this is permissible, well, that's permissible, as the whole bit. But there weren't the number of opportunities for women. That was the trouble. Now, I think it was a dressmaker that my mother used to visit in Moscow so much, a Mrs. Foster. I don't know whether you've run across that name or not, but she was from the South. There were a lot of people from the South, up north, after, this was enough after the Civil War, that they had lacking opportunities, they had come north, and she was from, I think, South Carolina. Very, very definite ideas of white supremacy over the Negroes. She expected the Negro to get off the street, and stand in the gutter until she walked by. A Negro didn't have any soul, but you didn't tell them, because of course they might do very bad things if you let them know, but they were just animals. And Mother said, in every other way, just a charming, lovely person, but that was the old South, you know. And there were a whole group, though, of Southern people came north, from Moscow to Lewiston. Now the Alfred brothers here were from the South, our Tribune family. But they were not, the men that ran were not as narrow. They had mixed in the world and they knew that other things and other ideas, so they themselves didn't carry these ideas. But they understood them, probably. And Jim Reed, the lawyer, who was a very close friend and one of the framers of the Idaho Constitution, from the South, not his family didn't feel that way, but he didn't. He had lived north long enough, and when a Southern becomes liberal, they're generally very liberal. Extremely so. You know, they are probably, because they really know the other side, they're probably a little better than the average just plain northerner. And some of them were very liberal, but there were some. Generally the women, I think, at that time carried the old feeling more, because they hadn't mixed in business as much. And so they carried the old feeling. Mm-hmm. I think it was more the women than the men. Unfortunately, I'm a feminist, but I think women probably have been the narrower all through on that. On race.
Was it a matter of race only? How much was there of north of the feeling of the desire of independence for the South?
Well, this was northern country, and the GAR were the like the American Legion today, and the GAR parades and the GARs. So, I imagine that it was northern that way, although I don't think that was excessive out here in the West where they hadn't fought. There were the soldiers from there, but and then they'd have a GAR parade or something, and they want to read your Idaho Constitution, and it's just very pro-northern. And yet one of the founders, one of the signers, the one from this territory, had fought in the Southern.
Catherine, there's someone here who's going to give you a ride.
Oh, okay.